History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Hey everyone, welcome to today's episode of History Unplugged. In this episode, we're going to be looking at the connection between the mafia in the United States and the government. How closely connected were the two? We know for a fact that they were very closely connected, definitely at city levels, like Kansas City and New York and Chicago. And the mafia or party bosses essentially controlled cities in many parts of American history in the early 20th century. But there are lots of theories that it went much higher than that at the state level or even the national level. One book that we'll use as an entry point is one called Double Cross, written by Chuck Giancara, who is the brother of the Chicago mobster, Sam Giancara. And it claims everything. Claims that Sam controlled Chicago, essentially, but made the JFK presidency possible, ordered the assassination of JFK, and basically controlled everything that happened in America for about 25 years. And we know that because the subtitle of the book is called The Mobster Who Controlled America. So let's start out by looking at Sam Giancara. He built up his Chicago street gang, the 42s, and integrated them into the Al Capone mob. The CIA was involved with Giancara to assassinate Fidel Castro, and Giancara and Jack Kennedy had simultaneous affairs with one woman, Judy Campbell. And I should mention that all these things are claims from the book, not things that have been corroborated by other sources. According to the book, his brother Chuck learned that Sam was one of the gunmen in the Valentine's Day Massacre of 1929, which is important because it established Capone as Chicago's undisputed crime boss. Giancara then took control afterwards. He also got the contract to kill Las Vegas casino operator Bugsy Siegel. He was the man who basically controlled the Vegas Strip throughout the 1940s. The Chicago mob apparently owned Franklin Roosevelt and then Harry Truman, whose careers they promoted. Giancara also had many athletes in his pocket, including Joe DiMaggio, Mickey Mantle, and Willie Mays, all of whom he used to party with in New York. Joe Kennedy was in Giancara's debt from his bootlegging days, and Giancara canceled a hit on Joe Kennedy, and in return, Joe swore that when his son Jack became president, he would owe Sam a big one. Giancara apparently used to fix horse races for J. Edgar Hoover, the leader of the FBI for several decades, and Giancara also partied in Lake Tahoe with Jack Kennedy and assorted prostitutes. And in these episodes, he apparently obtained a number of photos of JFK and sexually compromising pictures, and he used them to blackmail him. And he would have used them, but Giancara's friends in the CIA persuaded him not to. Frank Sinatra was also apparently a good friend of Giancara and the original conduit between him and the Kennedys. Later on, when they were closer with friends, he helped JFK win the presidency, and Giancara's influence extended all the way up through the Nixon administration. Back in the 60s, Sam Giancara worked with the CIA to try to assassinate Castro in Cuba. And Giancara conspired with other top mafia bosses, as well as Hoffa, Vice President Lyndon Johnson, Nixon, and top CIA officials, top military officials, and ballast police, all working together to assassinate Kennedy when Kennedy no longer served the interests of Giancara. He later arranged to have Bobby Kennedy assassinated too. And Giancara finally placed a hit on Jimmy Hoffa before he himself was murdered in 1975. Prior to his scheduled appearance before the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. So this book, Double Cross, basically places Giancara at the center of everything that happened from 1940 to the 1970s. He's like a Forrest Gump who just appears in every single significant event over and over again. He's basically responsible for everything that happens in American history except for the kidnapping of the Lindbergh baby. So in this book, a lot of historians don't think it's true because none of this can be corroborated. And there's no declassified intelligence that backs up what's claimed in the book. The reason I'm doing this episode is because it's in response to a listener question, Eric Gold. And Eric says, Scott, in a book titled Double Cross, written by Sam Giancara's brother, he says that prior to Harry Truman's stunning victory in 1948, Giancara told him that Truman was going to win, even if he didn't win. Given the mafia's influence in local politics and city government at the time, has the surprising election results ever been seriously investigated? The Senate investigation started after that election. Obviously, Joe Kennedy understood their influence for the 1960 presidential election. So in this episode, we're going to be looking at how the mafia controlled American politics. This episode will discuss events that are well corroborated, such as the mafia's involvement in the World War II effort, how it kept dock workers from striking. They had a heavy role in Teamsters unions. And if you want to see how this connection played out, you can watch the Martin Scorsese film, The Irishman, that looks at Jimmy Hoffa. The mafia did stop strikes during World War II, and it also provided intelligence for the military on the U.S. invasion of Sicily. Look at the way that machine party politics worked with Democratic politicians and labor unions and mob bosses. I did one episode on Tom Pendergast, who controlled Kansas City in the 1920s and 1930s. He would give contracts to his friends. He would push voters to vote for Democrats, and he would use the mafia in order to enforce all of this. So the mafia was the glue that held everything together. And specifically, we'll look at the story of Harry Truman, who's from my native Kansas City, or at least got a certain politics there. He was a soldier. He was a college dropout. He was a failed businessman. But Tom Pendergast made him originally a judge and then a U.S. senator and skidded everything to his rise as a president. And finally, we'll look at what happened to the Kennedys and their role with the mafia and how those two work together. One last thing I'll mention before I get too far into this episode is I'm going to touch on a theme that I've mentioned in previous episodes, and that's the concept of a monopoly of violence. A monopoly of violence is a term used by Max Weber, and the idea is that in the modern era, the only organization that can legitimately use violence is the state. If you just go out and fire a gun and kill people, you'll be sent to prison and you'll be charged for murder. However, if you are sanctioned by the U.S. military to fight in a war as a soldier and you kill an enemy combatant, that is lawfully justified by your state because your state has that monopoly on violence. If you're a police officer who kills someone within the line of duty, within proper police parameters, that is also justified. But in the past, the state did not have a monopoly on violence. If you went to, say, medieval France, okay, the king is the supreme ruler in name only. Really, you have thousands and thousands or tens of thousands of estates with various lords who each claim control in that area. If you're a serf, then your lord will protect you, or at least he'll claim to protect you. But if you wander off that state, then he can no longer protect you because he doesn't have a monopoly of violence there. Hundreds and hundreds and thousands of people claim the right to use violence in this type of situation. Now, this is the idea in the modern era that only the state has a monopoly of violence. But in reality, many other groups can claim it unofficially. Gangs in some areas, the mafia in other areas. In other nations, this type of polite fiction is even more pronounced. In Japan, the Yakuza will have heavy ties to sports. They'll have seats on a board, on a shareholders board in a large corporation. So a monopoly of violence is never a clear-cut thing, even in the modern era. In the 20th century, it definitely wasn't a clear thing because the mafia was very involved in the government. So that's what we're going to be looking at in this episode. So let's start with something clear cut when it comes to cooperation with the government and the mafia. Let's look at Operation Underworld. This was how strikes and labor disputes were resolved in the eastern shipping ports during World War II. During the early days of the war, the U.S. Office of Naval Intelligence thought that Italian and German agents were entering the United States through New York, working through immigrant communities, and these facilities were susceptible to sabotage. The loss of the SS Normandy in February 1942 especially, it raised fears and suspicions of the Navy about sabotage in these eastern ports. A Navy intelligence unit assigned more than 100 agents to investigate possible Benito Mussolini supporters within the Italian-American fishermen and dock worker population that worked on the waterfront. Well, the efforts didn't work. The dock workers and fishermen in the Italian mafia-controlled waterfront were tight-lipped and they did not speak to people that they shouldn't for fear for mob retaliation. So what the Navy did was contact Meyer Lansky. He was an associate of Salvatore Luciano and one of the top non-Italian associates of the mafia. They talked with him about a deal with the mafia boss Luciano. He was also known as Lucky Luciano and one of the highest ranking mafia both in Italy and the U.S. And at the time, he was serving a 30 to 50 year sentence for compulsory prostitution in Clinton Prison. In order to facilitate the negotiations, the state of New York moved Luciano from the Clinton Prison to the Great Meadow Correctional Facility, which is much closer to New York City. So the state of New York, Luciano, and the Navy struck a deal. Luciano would guarantee full assistance of his organization to provide intelligence to the Navy. Also, Luciano associate Albert Anastasia, who controlled the docks, guaranteed that no dock worker would strike throughout the war. In return, the state of New York agreed to commute Luciano's sentence. His actual influence in this matter isn't completely certain, but authorities noted that the dock worker strike stopped after the deal was reached with Luciano, so probably had a hand in it. After the war, right after the war, in the summer of 1945, at least in Europe, Luciano petitioned the state of New York for executive clemency, and he cited his help with the Navy. Naval authorities were embarrassed that they had to recruit mafia members in order to help out with the war effort and keep labor going, so they declined to confirm Luciano's claim. But the Manhattan District Attorney's Office validated the facts, and the State Parole Board all agreed to recommend to the governor that Luciano be released and be deported immediately. On January 4th, 1946, Governor Thomas Dewey, the former prosecutor who placed Luciano into prison, did commute Lucky Luciano's sentence on the condition that he didn't resist deportation to Italy. Dewey said, upon the entry of the United States into the war, Luciano's aid was sought by the armed services in inducing others to provide information concerning possible enemy attack. It appears that he cooperated in such effort, although the actual value of the information procured is not clear. So Luciano was deported to his homeland on February 9th, 1946. And there was all sorts of media hype of Luciano's role after his deportation, how much he actually was involved. The columnist and radio broadcaster Walter Winchell reported in 1947 that Luciano would receive the Medal of Honor for his secret services, which didn't happen. Okay, so that's a clear-cut case. Now let's look into something that's a little bit more convoluted. And that's the case of New York Mayor William O. Dwyer, who was mayor after World War II, and his connection with the mafia. He was a beloved mayor in New York. He was thought of as efficient. He lived down to earth. He didn't have the appearance that he was using city resources to better himself and taking bribes and graft and everything. But because of his connections to the mafia, he eventually ends up in Mexico. He doesn't flee to Mexico. He's given an ambassadorship to Harry Truman, which also raises the question of how much Truman was involved in all this. So I think that O'Dwyer is good because he shows how the mob worked with and alongside America's city governments in the 1930s and 1940s. And it's on the city level where by far mobs are the most active. So let's take the example of New York right after World War II. Syndicates worked with the city's political, law enforcement, and union leadership for their own benefit at the expense of the city and its people. This started at the waterfront docks when boats would arrive. And they handled more than $7 billion a year in shipping. So this was very lucrative to get involved with. Then it moved to the trucks that moved meat and produce to the city's stores. And then it moved to the beat cops who tolerated crimes like illegal betting and prostitution. Then it moved through the legal system, up through the courts that seemed like they were incapable of convicting the city's worst criminals. Witnesses would be bought off or they would be threatened or blackmailed. And this moved up to the waterfront unions that forced their members to turn over as much as 40% of their pay to the mafia as a protection racket or other things. This is based on an article by David Samuels in the Smithsonian about how this whole network was put together. And a lot of this information has only been recently declassified. So in ways that the U.S. and the public wouldn't understand for years, these types of arrangements were routine in cities in America's Northwest and the Midwest. And they formed a pillar of the nationwide Democratic Party that Franklin Roosevelt had built. Roosevelt built up the Democratic Party to become the powerhouse from the 1930s till the 1970s or 1980s. And it had been fairly weak nationally after the end of the Civil War when the Republican Party was dominant in the United States. It was very dominant among the African-American community, but Roosevelt changed that. He also reached out to labor unions, which were a key part of the Democratic base, and the Democratic Party on the local level would often employ the mob as muscle. This was an arrangement pioneered in New York City in the 1920s by the crime boss Arnold Rothstein, called The Brain. This structure was found in other cities like Chicago, and this was probably the most notorious mob town, where Al Capone ran it like a fiefdom. In Kansas City, arrangements were made by Tom Pendergast. He was once an alderman and Democratic Party chairman, and he ran a huge operation of patronage where he'd give out city contracts to friends, he would control elections, he would buy votes, he would give government positions to friends, and really anyone who had any sort of power in the city of Kansas City had to deal with Pendergast in one way or another. This cooperation between criminals and politicians wasn't just confined to local politics. During World War II, like I mentioned, the federal government worked with Luciano to make sure that the docks stayed open, but also factories. And they rooted out potential spies and saboteurs. And also, I did mention this, but they compiled detailed maps of Sicily, which the Allies invaded in 1943, and this intelligence was essential. They ostensibly kept communists off the docks after the war and worked with the U.S. government that way, and also kept them out of trucking companies. So if groups would unionize, it wouldn't fall to communism, and communist parties couldn't gain a foothold through organized labor the way that they had in Europe. So there was a web of personal and institutional relations between politicians and criminals, and it made it hard for people who thought of themselves as honest to see that anything was wrong, because this was just the order of business of the day. Where things start to get uncovered with O'Dwyer and where he enters the story has to do with a New York district attorney named Miles McDonald. And he began investigating the massive mafia machine in New York. And he began to unravel this web. And it all began in 1945 when he was investigating a bookmaker named Harry Gross. In order to figure out how Gross could operate a $20 million betting operation without attracting the attention of law enforcement, McDonald uncovered a conspiracy that connected cops on the street to the highest levels of the New York Police Department, who were connected, in turn, to politicians and crime bosses. By the summer of 1950, McDonald didn't have much time for really anything else, any kind of hobbies, because he was so involved in this case. He closed himself in a study in Brooklyn and worked all hours. He was chain smoking. And what he uncovered is that this web of corruption was all connected to William O'Dwyer, who was very popular at the time and people thought was squeaky clean. On July 10th, 1950, Ed Flynn, who was the powerful Bronx Democratic committee man, called the president, called Harry Truman with an urgent request for a meeting. We don't have any formal record of the meeting, but they must have discussed something about McDonald's investigation and what it might mean for the city. Because 2 days later, Truman met with Paul Fitzgerald, the head of the New York State Democratic Party and one of Flynn's closest political associates. The next week, the president met with Eleanor Roosevelt, who is still a power player in New York's Democratic Party, who'd also urgently requested a meeting at the White House. So this goes really, really high up. Maybe Eleanor Roosevelt was involved in all this. Truman and O'Dwyer were never close with one another. And O'Dwyer had signed a telegram urging Truman not to run for re-election in 1948. So that gives you an idea how frosty things were between them. He predicted that the president would lose, and he almost did. But the president also had plenty to fear from a public scandal that would reveal how much O'Dwyer ran New York and what such revelations would do in order to implicate him, and not just him, but urban Democratic politics across the United States. A decade earlier, Truman had barely survived the fall of Tom Pendergast, whose control over Kansas City ended when he was convicted for tax evasion in 1939 after a huge federal corruption investigation. Truman always feared that this scandal would follow him to the White House, and this fear was inflamed in 1947 after FBI agents began investigating Tom Pendergast's nephew, James Pendergast, who was a friend of Truman's from his army days during World War I, and they were investigating him for vote fraud. In response, Truman's friends in the Senate, who saw the FBI's involvement in Kansas City politics as a veiled threat, began their own investigation of the FBI. And J. Edgar Hoover kept all five volumes of the Senate's investigation records in his personal safe until he died, along with records of other disagreements he had with presidents that he thought threatened the power of the FBI. So what McDonald's investigation revealed was that Mayor O'Dwyer of New York was the front man for a system of citywide corruption that was administrated by his closest political associate, whose last name was Moran. And they knew, as the public would find out the next year from the testimony of a gangster named Irving Sherman, that O'Dwyer and Moran had been meeting personally with the syndicate boss, Frank Costello, as far back as 1941. And as a former chairman of the Democratic National Committee, Flynn also knew that the urban political operations that had helped elect Franklin Roosevelt to the presidency four times, and Truman once, were based on a system of alliances, kind of like an illegal get-out-the-vote operation. Putting O'Dwyer on the stand would put the Democratic Party in New York and elsewhere on trial. One way to keep O'Dwyer safe from McDonald's grand jury was to get him out of the country. So what Truman did is on August 15th, he appointed O'Dwyer as U.S. ambassador to Mexico. This was a post that he couldn't be recalled from except by the president. Even if he were called for trial, he couldn't testify. In a private letter dated August 18, 1950, Fitzpatrick expressed gratitude to the president for his decision. He said, "Your recent announcement of the pending appointment of the ambassador to Mexico proves to me your deep understanding of many problems and your kindness in rendering assistance." You really have to read through the lines here to see what's going on here. And of course, they're speaking vague because they never want to put anything into writing, even a private letter, that would implicate them legally. And he closed out the letter by saying, "May I just say thanks." Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. So we can't say with certainty which problems were being referred to, but they were big enough to persuade the president to immediately remove the popular U.S. ambassador to Mexico, Walter Thurston, and replace the mayor of New York. As Truman most likely saw it, by protecting O'Dwyer, he was probably protecting himself along with his party's future. I mean, the Democratic Party was riding high at this point. They rescued the country during the Great Depression. This is how the public considered them. It helped save the world from Adolf Hitler, but they were only able to do that because FDR was able to weld together a coalition of poor and dispossessed people on the one hand, many poor people, immigrant communities, people in the labor movement, welded together with progressive technocrats, even white segregationists in the South and labor unions and organized crime. This was a very, very messy alliance, and having some muscle behind it really helped keep it together. And in the midst of the Korean War, we're jumping to 1950, and facing new threats from Stalin in Europe, the coalition could crumble. And that's why keeping this alliance together and also keeping its unsavory elements under wraps was so important. On August 24th, O'Dwyer sent a personal note of thanks to Harry Truman. And he said, "The new assignment to Mexico, with which you have honored me, becomes increasingly important with each day." On August 31st, he resigned as mayor. So what's amazing is that it would take more than a decade for the public to hear the whole truth about the reach of organized crime in New York. And this happened when Joe Valachi, who was a mafia turncoat, shocked Americans in televised Senate committee hearings in October 1963. The hearings added momentum to the U.S. Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy's efforts to coordinate federal law enforcement against crime syndicates. And this is over the objections of FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover. Within months of the Valachi hearings, John F. Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas, and this was something that the attorney general could never forget, wondering if this was in retaliation. All right, so that's what's happening. That just gives you a little idea how this machine works. I want to jump back in time very briefly and take a closer look at the rise of Truman because there's so much about him that we do know. And I want to look at him and the Pendergast political machine that I was talking about. When Harry Truman visited Kansas City for the first time as president, this was in June 28, 1945, he did so to receive an honorary degree from the University of Kansas City. The crowd that gathered there was familiar, and they comforted him, particularly as he contemplated the challenges before him, which included the resolution of World War II. Here's a quote from his meeting. This comes from an article by John Taylor called "Harry Truman and the Pendergast Political Machine." And Truman said, "When I come to Jackson County, I can't realize that I am the president of the United States. I feel like I am just one of your fellow citizens. I see the same faces and I try to talk to the same people." And he told the crowd that he had attended the Kansas City School of Law for 2.5 years, but his work as a county judge prohibited him from devoting his full-time attention to finishing his degree. He said his time as a county official launched his political career, and this allowed him to ally himself with Kansas City's Democratic machine led by Pendergast, or as Truman liked to refer to his machine, the Democratic Organization. Truman's tenure as a judge in Jackson County, where Kansas City is, had a profound impact on Kansas City and Jackson County. As member of the county court, an administrative non-judicial body, it sounds like he's a judge handling legal matters, but he was more like an administrator back then. He showed attention to detail and he had to master the county budget. He encouraged his constituents to support bond issues during the Great Depression, which left a huge legacy on the environment of Kansas City. There were all sorts of buildings and infrastructure built by bonds, and this was before the New Deal. And in many ways, he created the financial framework for the New Deal that came later. Huge bond issues that would be paid out over years and years and years, and it was able to set a lot of people back to work. And his position as Jackson County judge was made possible by Tom Pendergast. Even though he was a member of the Pendergast machine, he wasn't completely a cog in it. He did develop a bipartisan strategy to reach out to Republicans as well. And he wanted to demonstrate to voters that these bond issues and these pre-New Deal projects wouldn't just benefit the Pendergast machine, but everyone. He also gained experience as a member of the machine that he took with him for the rest of his political career. This machine was racially, ethnically, and religiously diverse. It included Black Americans, Irish, Italians, Jews, Catholics, and Protestants. In 1939, Pendergast was convicted of income tax evasion and sentenced to serve time in Fort Leavenworth. The conviction came at a time when Truman had to decide whether he would seek re-election. He decided to organize a statewide campaign that appealed to a broad cross-sections of Missourians who supported the New Deal. So he was the first Missourian politician to also actively appeal to women, African Americans, farmers, and labor groups that had become important to New Deal constituencies. Well, Truman did not come from an elite background at all. He was born in Missouri in 1884 in Lamar, and they moved to live near their family in a rural area near Kansas City. In 1890, the family moved to Independence, Missouri, so that Harry and his brother and sister could attend the community's public schools. Truman graduated from Independence High in 1901 and then moved to Kansas City for employment. His time at the Union National Bank, where he worked after high school when he was in Kansas City, was short-lived. He had some odd jobs at the time. And in 1906, he was recalled by his father to work the family's 600-acre farm in the city of Grandview, close to Kansas City. He went and his father formed the Truman & Son Farming Venture. He worked the fields and he kept extensive farm records, much as he had done when he had worked in the bank in Kansas City. In 1914, Truman purchased a used Stafford automobile, which made it easier for him to travel back and forth from Grandview to Kansas City and Independence. 1917, he drove the Stafford to Fort Sill, Oklahoma, where he trained as part of the 129th Field Artillery for the First World War. He deployed to France in 1918 and was made captain of Battery D. It was a group of about 200 men that were mainly composed of Irish Catholics from Kansas City. This was a group closely associated with the city's Democratic Party, and this was the break of a lifetime that made it possible for Truman to go from being a farmer to becoming the president of the United States. His Battery D members and the contacts he made, including Tom Pendergast's nephew, Jim Pendergast, laid the foundation for his political start years after the war. When Truman returned to the United States, he married Bess Wallace and moved into her family's home in Independence. Then he decided to go into business with a former Army buddy, and the pair formed Truman & Jacobson, which was a haberdashery, sort of like a clothing store, in a sense, in Kansas City, but clothing store, general store combination. It provided shoes and ties to clients and was located downtown. Well, the store was also a gathering place for his old Battery D friends and other veterans of World War I, and where they could continue their relationships, so it would later serve Truman well into his political career. Battery D Sergeant Frederick Bowman recalled, "We used to walk up and around there, and sometimes you'd see some of the old fellows in there that would just come to say hello." But the venture didn't survive, and in September 1922, the store had a going out of business sale. Eddie Jacobson declared bankruptcy in 1925, and Truman wasn't able to eventually pay off his creditors until 1935. This is where he enters the political machine. Pendergast was a politician that doesn't really exist anymore in the 21st century. William Worley, a history professor at Metropolitan Community College in Kansas City, described him as a sort of a lost art in the 21st century. Pendergast was one of many political bosses across the country in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, but few were as effective. He inherited a strong organization from his older brother, and by the early 1930s, he controlled not only Kansas City and Jackson County, but had influence in the state house in Jefferson City in Missouri. So what political bosses worked with was what Worley called the lubricant of money. It took money to hire or pay off the people needed to deliver the votes. Pendergast got his money largely through protection schemes. He controlled the police department in Kansas City, particularly during Prohibition. And if he was paid protection money, he ensured citizens could do business as they saw fit. So he seemed to get a good deal of personal satisfaction from it. He was incredibly proud of helping people find work and helping them survive in extremely difficult times. So he was the informal social safety net of Kansas City during the Great Depression when the government wasn't stepping in. He portrayed himself as someone for the little guy. And in Kansas City, they called it Pendergast Prosperity. From about 1930 until Pendergast's downfall in 1939, Kansas City didn't feel the effects of the Great Depression as much as the rest of the nation did. So let's get back to how Truman encounters Pendergast. When his haberdashery store failed, Jim Pendergast, Tom's nephew, who served with Truman in France, went to Truman and asked him to run for Western Judge of the Jackson County Administrative Court. This was an administrative position. It was similar to being a county commissioner. And this went on to a 10-year stretch where Truman served on the Jackson County Administrative Court in various positions. He was a realist when it came to politics. He knew that you had to build coalitions, that you had to get support from groups that you might not always agree with. On the administrative court, Truman developed a reputation of being honest and a good leader and considered a man of his word. And the way that he was useful to Pendergast is that he gave him an impression of legitimacy. In 1934, Truman wanted to move on to become county collector, but Pendergast had already offered that seat to someone else and suggested a U.S. Senate seat for Truman instead. So there's no question in 1934, Worley says, that there was fraudulent voting in Kansas City and Jackson County. That's almost certainly what allowed Truman to get the winning margin and become a U.S. senator. After Truman's first speech on the Senate floor, Louisiana Senator Huey Long said, very proudly proclaimed that he wanted to welcome the senator from Pendergast. He was seen as being a product of the machine and basically just an empty suit. They'd be only there to represent Pendergast's interests, and that's all. But from the way he did business, he shows a much stronger independent streak. Pendergast's help for Truman ended in 1939 when he was sentenced to prison at Fort Leavenworth for tax evasion, and he lost most of his influence. During Truman's 1940 run for Senate, his opponents ran on Pendergast's conviction. Instead of receiving help from this connection, Truman needed to distance himself from Pendergast, which he did by moving his campaign office to the town of Sedalia, away from the Kansas City machine, and avoided any mention of Pendergast. Pendergast died in 1945, just days after Truman took off as vice president. So Truman left behind a legacy of a strong network of county roads in Kansas City. This is the work that he did as a judge. He set up a county courthouse, and his legacy and impact on Kansas City continued to grow even after he became a U.S. senator. Kansas City had already laid down a blueprint for its internal improvements in the 10-year plan before President Roosevelt became president and taking office in March 1934. Pendergast and others had set up their own proto-New Deal with bond issues and plans for infrastructure and ways for people to get back to work. So Kansas City was poised to take full advantage of the money that came from the New Deal building programs and the manpower and labor and everything else. And Senator Truman was in a unique position to support these programs from Washington. So New Deal programs like the Public Works Administration and the Works Progress Administration didn't provide complete funding for construction projects, but paid up to 30% and later 45% of the costs of labor and material. So Kansas City had already approved the bond issues, and the city used the bond money to provide the city's portion of the project funds to qualify for a federal match. So it's interesting that some think that the New Deal was based on what Kansas City was already doing. So who knows, maybe machine politics and the way that unelected officials and machine bosses and government contracts and all this cronyism work together was the template for the New Deal and the entire post-World War II economic order in the United States. And it's good that they started this up before Tom Pendergast left, because after his machine imploded, then, well, things got a lot worse for Kansas City. Harry Truman had to reassess his campaign strategy for re-election to the U.S. Senate in 1940. So he put together a campaign that drew on his experience working in an urban machine that had been supported by New Deal job programs. And he developed strategies to appeal to various constituencies, including women and labor leaders and African Americans. And this was an approach that he used again in the 1948 presidential election. Truman's strategies to appeal to women and labor evolved after he left Kansas City, and he came to understand the political value of African-American votes as a member of the Pendergast machine. As county judge, he supported funding for the Black Public Hospital in Kansas City, as well as the county home for orphaned African-American children. He appealed to African-Americans statewide in his 1940 re-election campaign, and he befriended Dr. William Thompkins, African-American doctor and staunch Democrat, who supported him and campaigned for him in 1940. He also befriended the editor of The Call, Chester Arthur Franklin, a Republican, who endorsed his political career at various points. Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors. So Harry Truman's complicated relationship with the Pendergast machine, well, what do we say about it? It's true that he owed his political start to the machine, but the graft and corruption troubled him. He said that he suffered from headaches, and one of the ways he dealt with his stress was to write about it. He'd sometimes spend the night in the Pickwick Hotel at 10th and McGee Streets in Kansas City. And sometime in 1931, he described these challenges and notes to himself in what came to be known as the Pickwick Papers. He criticized Pendergast for pressuring him towards some of the road contracts to his companies, but he also admired the boss when he wrote, "I am obligated to the big boss, a man of his word, but he gives it very seldom and usually on a sure thing." He, in times past, owed a body house, a saloon, and gambling establishment, but he's all man. I wonder what's worth more in the sight of the Lord. So Truman extended his criticism to some of his fellow elected officials when he wrote, "Should a man in public office see that his family and offspring are provided for, even though ethics and honor have to be thrown overboard?" One of my predecessors on the county court answered that in the affirmative. So whether right or wrong, Truman placed a high value on political loyalty, and so did Tom Pendergast. When Pendergast died in 1945, Truman didn't hesitate to travel to Kansas City on a military transport during wartime in order to attend Pendergast's funeral, and that caused a huge stir in the press. He took major flack for this, but Truman believed that he owed it to what he called the boss, as he called him, an opportunity to pay his last respects. So many focus on the graft and corruption as the legacies of the Pendergast machine, but there were other legacies in Kansas City and Jackson County, much of the county and the city's infrastructure and roads that were built during Truman's tenure as county administrator, and they're still being used today. So Pendergast created a diverse political machine, and he gave a template for how Democrats could win citywide and statewide elections, and Truman continued using this template even in later years when he argued he wasn't using illegal elements of the mafia in order to coerce people to be a part of it or to give up money to support it. And that's a little bit iffy, as we saw in the case of the New York mayor, O'Dwyer, later on in 1950. Okay, so that is the case of Truman. So let's jump ahead with one more thing and look at the case of the mafia and JFK. Investigative journalist Seymour Hersh wrote a book about the Kennedy presidency, and he argued that money, muscle, and influence of organized crime helped Kennedy win the closely contested 1960 presidential election. And once Kennedy was inaugurated, Robert F. Kennedy, his brother and attorney general, refused to pursue FBI evidence into widespread voting fraud. Hersh wrote in his book, The Dark Side of Camelot, which came out in the 90s, I think it was in 1997, that the mafia was brought into the Kennedy presidential campaign, and they helped the Democrats carry the key state of Illinois, mainly at the instigation of Joseph P. Kennedy Sr., Joe Kennedy Sr., who was the founder of the family political dynasty. One-time Kennedy pal Frank Sinatra also played a part in the re-election. He enlisted the aid of organized crime chieftain Sam Giancana, that we saw at the top of this episode, who claims he's responsible for everything that happened in America from 1940 to 1975, or at least his brother did. Well, Sinatra, Seymour Hersh at least corroborates that Sinatra brought Giancana into the struggle for the White House that Kennedy was fighting against Republican Richard Nixon. Tina Sinatra, the entertainer's daughter, told Hersh this, so good reason to believe it. Hersh says, and he relies on secondhand accounts, and he sometimes his account is laced with conjecture, tries to debunk some of the most romanticized elements of the JFK presidency and the legends it spawned, which have had an enduring impact on how America viewed its presidents throughout the 20th century. Hersh argued that because Kennedy was, quote, obsessed with sex and willing to take enormous risks to gratify that obsession, unquote, he made himself vulnerable to blackmail. According to an unpublished memoir by a Chicago lawyer and political operative whom Hersh cites, Kennedy was forced to pick then-Senator Lyndon B. Johnson as his running mate in 1960 when Johnson and his fellow Texan, then-House Speaker Sam Rayburn, threatened to divulge some unidentified episode from Kennedy's past. And Kennedy's Secret Service were always talking about how he'd run off and dodge protection in order to have a hotel liaison. This came up in an interview I had with Mel Eitan, who wrote a book about Secret Service accounts of serving presidents and all the juicy details that they spilled there. So Raskin claimed that Kennedy told him that Johnson and Rayburn were trying to frame him, and he said that they threatened him with problems, and he said he didn't need any more problems. I'm going to have enough problems with Nixon, he said. According to numerous other accounts, including the recollections of Theodore Sorensen, Kennedy's closest aide, Johnson was offered the vice presidential slot mainly because he could help the ticket carry Southern states. So that's not a sure thing that Kennedy gave them that position due to blackmail. So Kennedy's reckless tendencies, what Hirsch says, extended into foreign policy, notably his backing for undercover plots to subvert the regime of Cuban leader Fidel Castro and to assassinate Castro. These schemes helped pave the way for Castro to accept Soviet missiles into his country, leading to the United States' near cataclysmic confrontation with the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. Hirsch claims that Kennedy had a phone conversation with his predecessor, Dwight D. Eisenhower, in which the two men talked almost nonchalantly about the possibility of nuclear war. But again, we don't know if this is true or not. So let's get to the mafia connections. Kennedy's link to Sam Giancana through the president's relationship with a woman who is also Giancana's lover has been reported. But Hirsch argues that Giancana and other mafia leaders were helping actively the 1960 election. Joseph Kennedy was the catalyst in setting up the alliance with the mafia. The elder Kennedy allegedly got a Chicago judge and old friend, William Toohey, to arrange a meeting with Giancana. Joseph Kennedy purportedly sought to tap into the mob's influence with local labor unions, part of what Hirsch calls a huge manpower base that could be mobilized on demand. Hirsch reports that according to Tina Sinatra, Joe Kennedy also persuaded Frank Sinatra to act as a go-between in the campaign's contacts with Giancana. I believe in this man, John Kennedy, and think he's going to make us a good president, Sinatra told Giancana, whom he met on a golf course to escape FBI surveillance. The decision by the mafia to commit resources to the Kennedy campaign was made at a summit of the crime bosses in Chicago, according to Jean Humphreys, widow of the mob figure Murray Humphreys, who cast the only negative vote at the meeting. Robert Blakely, a former Justice Department special prosecutor, told Seymour Hirsch that FBI wiretaps confirmed that the mafia had been active in Kennedy's Illinois campaign, providing financial backing and stuffing ballot boxes. Can you say that mob money made a difference? Blakely asked rhetorically. My judgment is yes. And in the election, Kennedy did carry Illinois. It was a crucial win in the electoral vote contest, and he only won it by 9,000 votes out of more than 4.6 million casts. So any tiny thing could have made the difference. At the time, many Republicans charged that the Chicago Democratic machine, which was led by then-Mayor Richard Daley, had rigged Kennedy's victory. And Hirsch writes that Senator Everett Dirksen, a Republican senator, called Kartha DeLoach, then deputy director of the FBI, claiming that he had evidence of fraud and demanded an investigation. DeLoach told Hirsch that when he informed Dirksen, he would turn the matter over to the Justice Department, which was headed at the time by Robert Kennedy. The senator snapped, "Thanks a hell of a lot," and slammed down the phone. So Dirksen perhaps knew that the Justice Department had already advised the FBI not to conduct any further investigations. The reason mafia leaders were willing to egg Kennedy's candidacy was their belief that the Kennedys would do something for them. Hirsch writes specifically, reduce FBI pressure on their activities. If that was the case, the mob made a bad bargain because once in charge of the Justice Department, Robert Kennedy made fighting organized crime a priority. And Victor Novosky wrote in his book, Kennedy Justice, that ever since Prohibition, attorneys general have been declaring war on organized crime, but Robert Kennedy was the first to fight one. Okay, so one last thing we're going to look at in this episode is whether or not the mafia was involved in the JFK assassination. JFK was killed on November 22nd, 1963. On November 24th, 1963, his assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald, was also shot, and 2 hours later, he was pronounced dead by doctors at the Parkland Memorial Hospital, which was the same hospital where JFK had been pronounced dead just 2 days earlier. The identity of Lee Harvey Oswald was the subject of a lot of debate, but the man who killed Oswald was captured clearly on camera. His name was Jack Ruby. He was a Dallas nightclub owner who stepped out from a crowd of reporters under Dallas Police HQ and he fired a single round from his .38 Colt Cobra revolver and mortally wounded Oswald. Ruby told investigators that his motive was that he'd been in mourning since the president's assassination, and it was a man who he greatly loved. His grief reached the point of insanity, he said, and he felt compelled to spontaneously kill Oswald when the moment happened to present itself. The 1964 Warren Commission, the official investigation into JFK's assassination, looked into Ruby's whereabouts when Kennedy himself was killed. They said he was five blocks away and that Oswald was the only person responsible for Kennedy's assassination, and there was no other wider conspiracy. Well, an article I read on history.co.uk gets into recently declassified documents and goes into some of the gray areas and questions about Kennedy's assassination. And there's a lot that we still don't know because there's a lot that's still classified, but the argument is that it's not quite an open and shut case. 15 years later, the United States House Select Committee on Assassinations concluded that a conspiracy had been involved in the president's murder, but it couldn't be any more specific than that. After that, the conspiracy theory floodgates opened. Flash forward to 2020, and they still haven't been shut. Fuel was poured on the fire in 2017 when the U.S. government began releasing previously classified files on the assassination of JFK. Since the first release in mid-2017, around 55,000 documents have been made available for public consumption. The last batch was released in April 2018, and it's going to take years for historians to go through all of the documents and try to make sense of it. But in the short run, there have already been interesting things that have been revealed. For example, document 3214927 seems to directly contradict the findings of the Warren Commission in 1965 with regards to Jack Ruby. The document places Ruby at the scene of JFK's assassination and not five blocks away. It states, "Recently, a group manager in the Dallas Intelligence Division received information from a confidential informant that might be helpful in the investigation of the Kennedy assassination. The informant stated that on the morning of the assassination, Ruby contacted him and asked if he would like to watch the fireworks. He was with Jack Ruby and standing at the corner of the Postal Annex building facing the Texas School Book Depository building at the time of the shooting. The informant was named Bob Vanderslice, who relayed this information to his FBI handlers in 1977. Well, it doesn't state why it took 14 years for this info to come to light, but the file goes on to say that as soon as the shooting had occurred, Ruby turned and headed for the Dallas Morning News building without saying a single word to Vanderslice. If this informant is right, then Ruby was among the crowds who saw JFK get shot and seemed to have had prior knowledge of what was about to happen with his fireworks comment. For a long time, conspiracy theorists have tried to tie Ruby in with the assassination of JFK via his association with organized crime and the mafia. They believe the mafia are the only ones behind the wider conspiracy mentioned by the House Select Committee. After Fidel Castro's revolution in Cuba, the mob lost big financial interests in the country. The mafia was unhappy that Kennedy had failed to topple Castro via his failed Bay of Pigs invasion, and were goaded by the fact that Kennedy's younger brother, Attorney General Robert Kennedy, was making it a personal crusade to tackle organized crime. So the mob decided to change the man at the top. That's what the conspiracy says. Oswald was to be the fall guy and Ruby the man to silence him. So why would Ruby carry out something like this? Conspiracy theorists say that Ruby, who is known to have mafia connections, got into debt with the mob and had to kill Oswald in order to repay that debt. When Ruby was interviewed in 1964 as part of the Warren Commission, he repeatedly spoke about being in danger. He said he wished to tell the truth, but couldn't do so until he was in a safe location. Since the commission had no police powers, they were unable to offer that to him. Well, Ruby died of a pulmonary embolism in 1967, and whatever secrets he had died with him. Chief counsel and staff director to the House Select Committee at the time, G. Robert Blakey, concluded that the most plausible explanation for the murder of Oswald by Jack Ruby was that Ruby had stalked him on behalf of organized crime, trying to reach him on at least three occasions in the 48 hours before he silenced him forever. The release of this new document seems to fan the flames of conspiracy theories, but with most theories associated with JFK, the concrete evidence there is still elusive. There's no smoking gun. Now, it could be contained with the final set of classified documents that have yet to be released. President Trump said that in April 2018, that those files be kept from the public until October 26, 2021, due to, he said, identifiable national security, law enforcement, and foreign affairs concerns. So by then, people will be able to finally decide with themselves what the mafia involvement was with JFK. All right, that's all for this episode. So that gives you an idea of what was happening. It's almost impossible to exactly pin down the structure of mafia involvement with politics because they have to be secret by nature. A lot of what we know comes years or decades after the fact by memoirs or biographies where things can be made up and someone is either deemed to be almost completely innocent or they're this larger-than-life mastermind that's controlling everything that's happening in the United States. It's very hard to know, but what is clear is that the mafia has always challenged the notion of a monopoly of violence by the United States government and elsewhere, and organized crime had a very large role to play in American politics in the 20th century and probably will for time to come. All right, well, that is all I have to say for today's episode. Now, I would be remiss if I didn't thank the Spymasters or History Unplugged who make this podcast possible. I'll explain what Spymasters are in a second. Here they are, some real names, some aliases. Willie from New Jersey, Sumo 41, Sergeant Hooch, Los, Bruce Ashby from Wire Meets Wood Guitars at wmwguitars.com, Belivy, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Salvador Sanchez, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Michael Piccinetti, Nick Brooks, Jeff Mitchell, owner of Mountain West Commercial Las Vegas, Josh from VFW Post 2285, Michael from New York and Vermont, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jake Harrington, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams where I do live versions of podcast episodes where you can leave feedback as I'm talking and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a three-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.